The What in God's Name Summer Replay is a three-part trilogy. Today's replay, Trilogy 1, Part 2, Praying for Your Enemies. Are You a Sucker? Part 2 of our conversation with Kathleen McTeague, which aired on February 6th, 2020. Welcome to What in God's Name. She is Shayna Appel.
And he's Chris Owen.
Guess what, Shayna?
What, Chris?
January was our best month to date with listenership.
All right. Way to go, listeners. Yay.
I ascribe this to two reasons. One, I think people made some New Year's resolutions about living a healthier lifestyle, and What in God's Name is good for your health.
Okay. So in other words, we should see this drop off immediately in February.
Yes. I'm preparing us for the immediate drop off as people's New Year's resolutions fade.
Yes.
My number two reason why January was our best month is that I posted several pictures of Arlo on social media.
Now that always gets us a bump.
Arlo is Shayna's Shih Tzu, and Arlo has more fans than both of us combined, I think, Shayna.
Yeah, I think that's a safe assumption.
I also wanted to share with you an update on my fascination with Alexa.
Oh, God, what have you done now, Chris?
So last show, I mentioned again Alexa, and I got an email from one of our listeners who has Alexa in her car, and when I say on the show, Alexa, Alexa wakes up. And I don't know what Alexa does in this car, but the listener wrote me an email and said I had done it again by saying Alexa on our show.
And now you've done it like eight times here already. Maybe we should just refer to it as the A word.
So she said, you've done it again, you dork. So you, by calling me a dork, have apparently given our listeners permission.
It's catching on.
We are welcoming aboard new listeners, as I say. And so, Shayna, I do. Yes, I'm going to do this reset that might take 3 minutes, because what we're doing on What in God's Name is not immediately obvious. Yes, we are doing current events and culture, using philosophy and theology as tools for analysis and understanding what in God's name is going on in the world. That's what we do. But what does this mean? To explain more clearly what it means to do theological and philosophical reflection on current events and culture, I want to share what it doesn't mean. So we had a response from a listener about our show, Shayna, and the listener said, you can tell what side they're on, that is, they being you and me, and meaning what political side we're on. Or to be blunt, what she meant was, Chris and Shayna are politically liberal, and they don't try to hide it. That made my heart sink for a couple of reasons. One is, I would not describe myself as politically liberal.
No, I just make you look that way. I'll wear the badge proudly. I admit it.
Secondly, though, my heart sank because the very premise of our show is to call into question the assumption that political categories should be in the forefront, should be foregrounded, that political categories should frame our thinking and should frame our public conversations in the first place.
Yes.
And this is hard because we're bombarded with messages in the media that want to frame everything as red v. blue because it sells.
But in today's world, if you are attempting to live your life in emulation of, pick your prophet, Jesus, Muhammad, Buddha, you're going to be called a progressive, whether you are politically or not.
But what you've just said, I think, is just an example of how people, like, if you're talking about theological and religious things, and people in their mind, their immediate reaction is to frame that as a political stance, that's exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah.
That we, What in God's Name, is pushing up against. What should be foregrounded is theological and philosophical perspectives. When I say philosophical, I mean moral, if you're not a religious person.
Mm-hmm.
But so you basically just gave an example of what I think, you're right, does happen, but that we're pushing up against and questioning and saying, let's examine the assumption that politics is primary. So we do have a show axiom that I haven't said for a while, which politics is downstream of culture. Politics is derivative of human nature, of morality, of vision of what is just in society. Politics arises out of that. And so What in God's Name aims to examine the more primary questions of what is good, what is beautiful, what is true, what is just. And so you, our listeners, we want you to listen to our show. And also we want to invite people to share in this message of, and this critical examination of, why do we foreground politics? And let's not do that. You know, let's go deeper.
Yeah. Yeah. Which requires practice. And, you know, it's, as always, it's about stepping out of the cultural flow, reconnecting to that which is bigger than us and bigger than most everything around us, however you do that, in whatever context you do that.
Do you want to set up part two of our Kathleen McTeague interview?
So this is part two of our interview with Reverend Kathleen McTeague, who is with the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee. And today we get into, with Kathleen, a bit of her own journey from being a secular activist into being a faith-based activist. And I think for those of us who have ever wondered how to bring our faith forward into the public square in a way that's not obnoxious, this is a wonderful example of what it means to be a faithful person in the public square, to bring those virtues forward into our world.
Having a sense of morality and bringing that to bear in public conversations, public issues.
Yeah, and letting go of the, you know, letting go of the self-righteousness, you know, that sort of self-righteousness that is so often a part of our political movements. And it's shrill and it's not attractive. And in my book, it lacks some depth. And our listeners will hear this. Listen for this. This is the part where she talks about it being aspirational.
Yeah.
It's reach. It's not, you know, something we can lay claim to, but more something that we're reaching for. So with that, I don't know, Chris, you want to start the interview?
Yeah, let's have a listen. I'd like to circle back to your biography a little bit. And I understand that you were a political activist in your young adult life. As part of that activism, you spent time in Nicaragua. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. That was more than 30 years ago. It was a long time ago. So I had spent a year and a half living in Spain right after my undergraduate days, and I was living pretty hand-to-mouth there. And I was just in love with Spain. I just adored Spain, and I really wanted to gain fluency in Spanish. So I ended up living there till that happened, till I got to a point where I felt really quite fluent with the language and very comfortable with it. And then I came back to the United States, and I was very young. I think I was 24, maybe, when I got back to the United States, and didn't know, you know, what the next thing would be. So I moved to the Bay Area, where I had some friends, San Francisco Bay Area, and began working with a series of nonprofit organizations. Did that for a few years and continued my political activism. I was very active with this core group of activist friends on, you know, anti-nuclear work. And it was in the era when there were many refugees fleeing Central America. It was the years of the generals, right, the dictators in those countries. And there was a massive amount of violence and human rights violations there. So I also began to be involved in that. But simultaneously, I began to feel the stirrings of some spiritual needs. And I had been raised Catholic. I knew I wasn't a Catholic any longer, but I didn't know what I was instead. I began exploring Buddhist meditation, which I still do now. But after a few years of kind of hit-and-miss exploration, I decided to go to seminary, not because I had a vocational intention, but because I wanted to find a more serious place to do the spiritual exploration. I went to a seminary called Starr King, named after a famous abolitionist who was a Unitarian, Thomas Starr King. I think as a low-risk venture in my own mind, because it meant I could keep on working, I didn't have to relocate, et cetera, right? So I went for my own exploration, but I continued to be involved with this flow of refugees. And during my first year in seminary, I heard about this organization called Witness for Peace, which at the time had just been founded. And it had been founded because in those countries that were so racked by the depredations of dictators and military governments, there had been a successful revolution. That was in Nicaragua. and the dictator Somoza had been overthrown by the Sandinistas. And immediately the United States started a counter-revolution, supporting the Contra fighters who were based in Honduras and a little bit in Costa Rica. So Witness for Peace was started as an attempt by U.S. citizens to end the U.S. fomenting of that war. That was really what it was focused on. And I felt quite compelled by that because I spoke Spanish, because I'd been involved with Central America refugee work, and actually because Witness for Peace defined itself as a faith-based organization. And I had never worked before with all of my political work had been in secular organizations. So I was curious about that. And so I dropped out of seminary after my first year, and I moved to Nicaragua during the Contra War. This would have been in the fall of 1984 is when I went there. And Witness for Peace's strategy, it's interesting given the work I've ended up doing right now, but Witness for Peace's strategy was to have long-term volunteers, 6 months minimum is what that was for, who were Spanish speakers, based in Nicaragua and based in some of the war zone areas, so that we could host short-term delegations of U.S. citizens who could come and see what was actually happening, the damage the United States was causing in their name, and would then return home and work against the war. That's actually where my concept of a different kind of immersion learning arose, because with Witness for Peace, the idea was not that you were bringing anything to Nicaragua. It's what you were going to do when you got back home. That's the idea of service that I believe in, is that when you get changed by the proximity you've gained, when you have that kind of deep learning experience, you become a different kind of justice activist when you go back home. So I stayed there for 6 months, and it changed my life. I know people say that easily, but it changed my life in some very precise and important ways. One of the ways it changed my life was that Witness for Peace was a collection of people who were grounded in their own faith and also deeply grounded in the philosophy and practice of nonviolence. And though I had certainly read about Gandhi and read about nonviolence before, this was my first exposure to seeing people try to put it into practice. So there you are in a war zone. People are being horribly damaged by the violence around them all the time. And I was in circles of people, both Nicaraguan and U.S., who would pray in the morning, not only for wisdom and for guidance and for safety, but for the safety and the guidance of the adversaries. And that was new to me. That was something really new, a radical intention to maintain the humanity of the enemy, of the adversary, to not forget that that is a human being on the other side of that rifle. So that was a profound change for me to understand what it could mean to live that way. The second one was that I had not figured out that there could be a way to bring together my spiritual hunger with my political commitments. And the people that I was working and living with in Nicaragua didn't experience them as separate things. They were living them together because that's how they experienced them. Their faith was the grounding for their political activism. And I learned from that. And when I came back to the United States, I returned to seminary with a completely new openness to the possibility that there could be a vocation there for me after all, that there might be within ministry a place to bring the spiritual grounding and the political commitments together in one place.
So you had the experience of political activism apart from or separate from spiritual grounding, and then was exposed to political activism that was grounded in the world of spirit.
Right.
How is your own experience of yourself as a political activist, how did that change as you became more grounded in coming from faith?
So the most, I guess I would say the original change that I experienced became an aspiration, which I feel that I've tried to live up to for the rest of my life since then. That's why I say this was a life-changing experience. What I found in working with people who were doing the political engagement, working against injustice from their spiritual grounding, was a really different orientation toward the whole concept of justice and what it means to be a political activist, what it means to engage in justice activism. And the best way that I have been able to articulate it, because it's not easy to bring it forward into words. Sometimes it's more something you intuit or sense. But for me, the easiest way that I could bring it into words is to talk about what we sometimes think of as virtues, like humility. So I will tell you that in the secular activism that I had engaged in before that point, which was partly, you know, also flavored by being very young and being, you know, working with a whole lot of other young adults who are always positive about what's right and wrong and sure of the direction in which we ought to be going and furiously angry at the things that are, you know, keeping justice from happening in the world and so forth. So it probably had something also to do with my age at the time. But that kind of self-righteousness that we can bring forward into our political commitments is never helpful. And it is often profoundly destructive. It allows us to stay in that us and them dichotomy, right? We are the righteous ones, right? We're the ones who have the answers. We are the ones who are on the good side. And all y'all have either got to disappear or change your ways. So what I witnessed in people that I first saw there in Nicaragua, many of whom were priests and nuns, by the way, not with Witness for Peace, but people who had chosen to walk with the people of Central America, people who were from Italy or from Spain or from the United States or from England, Catholic priests and nuns who were spending all of their lives, their entire lives, walking with some of the most impoverished communities who were now also the communities suffering the worst violence. Some of them, of course, were murdered, like the four church women who were murdered in El Salvador in the 1980s. Oscar Romero is another example, right? They weren't all foreign. People who walked all the way to their own deaths because of their faith-based political commitment. And I had never been so inspired by people who were not dead heroes, but people I actually could speak with and get to know who were moving from a place of such humility and were so willing to say they didn't know. And that would fill their prayers, you know? Guide us, help us to know, keep us compassionate, remind us that these others are still our sisters and our brothers. I mean, there's just a completely different ethic that gets cultivated, deliberately cultivated, by that kind of stance. And if you bring that into the justice engagement, then how you do that engagement is changed as well.
Is it your experience of yourself and your observation of others that spiritual practice makes those virtues easier to cultivate? Is that a fair statement, or would you tweak that?
I was very deliberate in naming what I just talked about as an aspiration, because as filled with admiration as I have been for the people who I think fulfill it the best, many of whom I feel that I've met in Central America, including very recently in Central America, I don't feel that I do it as well as they do, right? I mean, I haven't chosen to live in a place of profound danger or profound poverty. I live a very comfortable life. And so I'm very cautious about naming what I try to do as an aspiration, as opposed to like, this is now who I am, you know?
But yeah, so I get that. My question is more about, and it's a question I live with, so that's why I'm asking it. And I just wonder, and I suppose there's no real way of knowing, of course, the inner life of other people. All we have is what, you know, the data is our
what
own spiritual
see.
Journey.
Sure.
Biographically, I don't feel like I could cultivate some of those virtues that you've named without spiritual practice. So I guess what I'm wondering is, do you think that spiritual practice makes cultivating those virtues easier?
Yeah, absolutely, I do. I don't know anyone in whom I see those virtues who doesn't have a very steady spiritual practice. And the reason why I think that it takes that kind of practice is the same reason it takes practice to do anything well. If you want to learn to play the violin, you're going to have to practice. If you want to learn a foreign language, you're going to have to practice. If you want to be a more patient human being, if you want to be a more compassionate human being, a more humble human being, you got to practice those things.
I loved a couple of the virtues that you've named, humility being one. And then as you were describing the folks you were with in Nicaragua, the ability to see the humanity of the other, that whole sense of not objectifying.
Which I think is compassion, again. I think it's a practice of compassion. I think it is also, though, one of the core reasons why spiritual practice is so important. And it's this. I mean, so first of all, let's say spiritual practices come in a huge variety of flavors, right? Lots of different forms of prayer, lots of forms of meditation, kinetic practices like yoga or Tai Chi or walking, right? I have a colleague whose name is Jorge Esquivel, who lives in Colombia, who helped me, because of his own thinking, to boil it down to three elements that make something a practice. It's like if you were saying, okay, what makes this just a walk versus now this walk is a spiritual practice? What's the difference?
Shana, I love listening to Kathleen, and I think I said this last time, just was a pleasurable time to be with her in conversation. Her life story, illuminating.
Incredibly inspiring. It's inspirational and aspirational. And I think that the part where she was talking about activists in Nicaragua praying for the opposition, I think, is a soft word. I mean, the enemy, these people were incredibly violent. They were killing people, and yet they could still pray for them. And I think, God, in today's world right now, just even in American politics, the capacity for folks who support Donald Trump and, the rest of the nation to be able to look across and to see each other's humanity. And, I'm sure the same is true from the side of the Trumpians when they're looking our way, because if people on our side are looking at you and calling you an abomination or what, a deplorable, if people on our side are sitting here and calling you a deplorable, I mean, ouch.
I want to ask you a provocative question, Shana, that I ask myself and wrestle with myself. If you see the humanity in the other, if you are nice and play by the rules, aren't you going to get run over?
Not necessarily. And I'm thinking here about the martial art of Aikido, in which you effectively use the other's hostility against them. But at the end of the day, you don't meet the hand that's coming down on your head and grab it and get locked in the struggle. You simply get out of the way. I don't think the purpose is to lay down and get steamrolled.
It's interesting, as I reflect on myself, even asking that question and your response, it's all part of responding to evil with good and how much trust that really takes.
I am a peace activist, but I'm not a pacifist. And there is a time where I am inclined to say no more of this and not stand idly by and watch my neighbor get the crap kicked out of him or lay down and get the crap kicked out of me. Because that's not what I understand I'm called to.
Let's circle back to this notion of humility that Kathleen raises. And she frames it as, in this war zone, these people who were an inspiration to her, being able to see and continue to see the humanity of the people who are actually out to kill them. Wow.
It's so powerful. It does. It reminds me of Jesus. The historical Jesus in his day and in his time, who stood in that pot of crap, that oppressive pot of crap, and refused to be identified by it, refused to be manipulated by it, refused to be driven by it. So when we refuse to allow ourselves to be defined by or driven by what is around us, we are now in a position to begin defining it. And that is an incredibly powerful place to be. So if people look at these people and see the meek, then let me tell you who the meek are not. If you conflate meekness with weakness, you're about to be very surprised, and it may not be pleasant. It takes an incredible amount of power to not be defined by what's going on around you, especially when what's going on around you threatens your very existence.
That reminds me of the literature on leadership, which begins with the idea that the leader needs to be self-differentiated from the morass, the mess that surrounds the leader. And it's only by that self-differentiation that the leader can then be truly effective in leading the people, the organization, to a different place.
And Chris, I will tell you, as a former firefighter, paramedic, there's a reason why when we step into rushing waters to do a rescue, we are tethered to something immovable, okay? There is a reason that we do that, so that we don't get swept away by the waters. In the public realm, in the public sphere, we have got to be tethered to something. And this is a place that you and I come back to so often. You know, for me, it's faith. The virtues, as Kathleen said, you know, the virtues of faith that tether me to those virtues in an aspirational way, that remind me who and whose I am and what it is I'm striving for, so that I know when I've missed the mark. Because otherwise, you know, I mean, if we all just jump into rushing water, tethered to nothing, you know, I can tell you where you're going to end up. You know, downstream, if you're lucky, if not, at the bottom.
My takeaway for today is inviting our listeners to think of themselves as leaders within this rushing water of our public life. So when, you know, I raise the example of the self-differentiated leader, and I think it's easy for all of us to say, oh, that's somebody else. The leader is somebody else. And my invitation as a takeaway is that we all, I mean, that's part of what we're inviting people into in this show, for us to consider ourselves, each of us, as leaders, needing to self-differentiate or find the anchor, the tether, as you beautiful, beautiful metaphor. Yeah, that's all of our callings, so that we can help things get better.
Yeah, I mean, it is time for those who are tethered to lead. You know, when you were talking, I suddenly heard Maya Angelou's voice in my head, and her poem, Still I Rise. And that whole poem is about how other people and the culture are trying to drag her down. And she simply refuses to go down because she is bound to an image of self that comes from within and may be faith, you know, infused, but is not solely derived from the rushing waters. So, you know, she's not going down. She's just, still I rise, still I rise. And I love that image of, you know, of the people who are tethered rising up, not in a violent way, but rising up and redefining the sphere that we're in. And personally, I mean, again, I always drop back onto the faith because that's my school of thought, but it's not exclusive to that. One can be tethered to lots of things. I know plenty of moral and ethical people who are not faithful people, but damn it, you've got to be tethered to something. That's my takeaway for the day.
Thank you, Shana. That is beautiful. Be curious.
Go deep.
And shine light. We're so glad that you could have joined us today, or that you did join us today.
Or tomorrow, or the day after.
The metaphysics of time on a podcast.
Yes, the magic of the podcast.
Our webpage, whatingods.com, WHATINGODS. You can check us out there. On the landing page, there are buttons for how to listen. Our Facebook, at What in Gods, posting 2 or 3 or 4 times a week, sometimes with pictures of Arlo, who is, of course, our most favorite mascot. Leave a review somewhere. Facebook, Apple Podcasts, on a cocktail napkin or a beer mat at the pub.
We'll be there. We will pick it up. Just tell us where you left it.
Leave a review somewhere. And I just wanted to mention, during Lent, we will have our annual fund drive. That will start at the end of February. Anything else to add, Shana?
No, Chris, but it has been great, as always, to spend the morning with you.
Lovely. See you next time.